BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Davey Scott here, popping into your podcast feed with another uncut treat for you. Our featured record this week is an absolute cracker, The Remote Part by Idlewild. It was summertime when I had a socially distanced chat with Rod and Roddy from the band, and as you'll hear, theirs is a very special relationship. They're not just co-songwriters, they're the best of friends. And as we chatted through the making of this album, they finished each other's sentences, they were hitting it with in-jokes, all that stuff that demonstrates a really strong bond. There was lots to talk about. And to kick things off, I told the guys that many fans of this podcast had specifically asked us to do an episode on The Remote Part. Of all other albums, this is the one that seems to strike the loudest chord.
I think this specific record is one that we have. It was always known to us as the most successful record, definitely commercially, but I suppose its predecessor, 100 Broken Windows, was the one that people tend to reference the most as a kind of a cult record, I suppose. And so this one, I suppose in a lot of ways, is the ones that I was the most proud of, in the sense that I thought it was the hardest leap forward, because we'd leapt so far forward from Hope Is Important to 100 Broken Windows. It was almost really, really impossible to do that again, you know. And so to make a record that did what it did, and I think that listening back to now, which I recently did before we came today, is really strong all the way through. There's not really any moments where I cringe too much, which you tend to do when you look at a photograph of yourself a long time ago, you know. I know that that's obviously a record that seemed to resonate and connect with a lot of people in Scotland at that time. So yeah, it's surprising that that's one probably over 100 Broken Windows to me.
Yeah, I think it's the tunes sort of unite people. It's the tunes on The Remote Part are really strong. The melody is really strong, and I think whereas Hope Is Important was more kind of, I guess, punk rock influenced, and 100 Broken Windows was kind of on the way somewhere more tuneful, but kind of a sort of pure moment between places, The Remote Part was just full of these really accessible tunes. But the band were seen as a, like Rod said, kind of a more of a culty indie rock band. So that's why The Remote Part, I think, resonates, because, you know, like, you might be 14 years old and you're playing it in your bedroom when it came out, and your dad and mum might also like it. And then so the family then have this band that they like. And I think The Remote Part is one of those records that sort of brought a lot of, made a lot of fans, because of just, like I say, the tunes were so strong.
And we'll get into some of that, because, you know, the melody is, I think, again, let's just even just revisiting it over the past couple of days, it's, the tunes are like, wow, you know, the melodies are really kind of expressive. And But just to sort of finish this little part of the story, because there is, you know, that kind of pivot, isn't there, you know, between those early kind of records and the yeah, live kind of identity that you had. What do you think were the things that made that happen? What were the drivers for that kind of change?
Well, The Remote Part was a record that took a long time to get going. I'm sure Dave Eringa will elaborate on that, and obviously Rod as well, but we tried it out with a few different people. So 100 Broken Windows, like Rod was saying, it was such a step on from Hope Is Important. So we were in this different place now, and it was quite commercially, you know, relatively commercially successful and critically acclaimed. Because before that, around Hope Is Important, we were just sort of seen as a night out for students, like this kind of crazy live band that, you know, people didn't expect us to last too long. Then 100 Broken Windows came out, and I think the critics and other sort of sceptics were starting to think, wait a minute, this is a really interesting record, it's a really interesting rock record. They've got an identity which is kind of unusual. So I think everyone was expecting something from us for the follow-up to 100 Broken Windows, and including the record company. So we started off recording it with Stephen Street, who obviously has had big success with Blur and The Smiths. I'm a massive Smiths and Morrissey fan, so I was very excited to work with him. And that was the idea, was going to be that kind of record. It was going to be a Blur-esque Smiths, you know, it was going to be a record that was, what's the word I'm looking for?
Popular?
A crossover. Like a crossover record.
Successful.
That's what they were hoping that we were going to do. So Stephen came on board because he had a lot of success with Parlophone, the label that we were on, making these kind of albums. So it started off like that, and that didn't work out so well. And then we went to, on a complete U-turn, we ended up recording with Lenny Kaye from the Patti Smith Group in New York. I'm thinking that that was going to be that kind of record, you know, because I was, it's a long story, we can get into that, I guess, with the, how we got to meet Lenny and how Lenny ended up doing that. But Lenny informed what we were going to do, really. That's the best way to put it, isn't it? He was kind of like a guiding light, like a wise owl of rock and roll. He told us the way, he showed us the way, and then we went with Dave Eringa. And
what was the way, according to Lenny?
Well, I remember.
We weren't really sure what any of the songs were. We weren't sure what form they were taking. We weren't sure if we were a you know, essentially a pop group or an indie group or a punk band or whatever it was. And I suppose when he came to see us play just before we were planning to record a couple of acoustic songs with him, and he came to see the gig at the Bowery.
He actually came to see us a few times, yeah. And then we went out for a pizza with him in Lombardi's, and he's like, he's just such a great guy.
But he also was like, you're a rock band, so you should do rock songs. But they don't rock songs don't have to be, you know, just screaming and shouting. And I guess a pivotal moment, I suppose, was, him sitting in front of us in a rehearsal room while we were trying to piece together this acoustic song into a kind of a band way of thinking, which is something we'd never really done before. You know, we'd written a song kind of how it sounded, with a riff and then a lyric and a drum part. And so he was taking this song and sort of standing and dancing in front of us. We're all bright red in the face, embarrassed about the fact that he's dancing around barefoot, like pointing at us, going, you know, pointing at Colin, telling him when to hit his drums. All of us looking like, who's this lunatic? But at the same time, it suddenly sort of turned into this much more kind of dense, interesting thing, you know. And we're, at the time, we're all, wow, okay, where did that come from, you know, I guess. And although it, in a sense, I suppose we were quite easily led in that way by Lenny, and it maybe took a few too many meanderings off in avant-garde directions for the label, and maybe for the song, it kind of gave birth to that, what became American English in that way, and sort of informed, as Roddy said, like what we were going to do with the rest of the record, and that we could take these kind of ideas, basic acoustic ideas, and turn them into a band song, and that you could kind of write a song in any form and then let the song dictate how it was going to be recorded, or how it was going to sound.
He sort of deconstructed rock and roll for us, you know, and talked us through it. And, and, you know, like he put together the Nuggets, you know, box set, which is like, I guess, like sort of benchmark garage rock. And he would talk about that as if it was like, those songs sound so simple, but they're also so complicated, and the way they're being structured together, and everything is just, there's the economy of rock and roll, I guess. You just need what you need. So like, that's what he would do with us. He would take our songs back to what the actual essence of them was, which was like a really good tune. And that would be the focus of it. And it would not, you know, and before that with the Stephen Street production, it all had been a different thing completely. So it was taking it right back to that poem, especially with a song like American English, which he was really interested in the idea, because it's sort of based on the Walt Whitman idea of like, you know, like you're singing the song back to yourself, really. It's a reflection of yourself in the song. He was really into that, and he didn't want anything around. Like, he wanted me to speak it, didn't he? He was like, he didn't even think singing was needed. He's like, this idea is like, just speak it. You don't need to sing it. So he was kind of radical in that way. But he's also just a really fun man. And I just remember sitting in Prospect Park with him in Brooklyn and eating sandwiches and just listening to stories. And just to be in his presence was very inspiring. Ultimately, the record company weren't that interested in the music that we made with them. They thought it was a bit like, they just felt it was a bit undisciplined, I suppose. And they thought, right, okay, well, you've had such a good time and you've learned a lot. Let's get Dave Eringa back on board, because Dave Eringa had produced 100 Broken Windows. Let's get him back on board and take these ideas that you've learned from Lenny, and let's make a record together. And that's when, you know, the main songs came from that.
So that's, yeah, so, but, and you know, I may have got this sort of, you know, your timeline wrong, but the songs were all there, weren't they?
So you
went back and wrote again.
And we actually, another significant thing about it is we went up to the Highlands to do this, because we had all these sort of disparate ideas and bits of songs, and we had 8 recorded properly, which all ended up mostly being B-sides, didn't they?
Yeah.
So that's why the B-sides in The Remote Part are so good, because most of them are produced by Stephen Street. So we went up to Highlands in Inchnadamph up in Sutherland. We got a wee house in a sort of Big Pink style. We just holed down there for like almost a month, really, and wrote the record.
Right, so that to me is that's just endlessly fascinating because when you start changing the way that you write, I suppose is when doors start opening and windows start opening, all the rest of it. And so talk us through that experience of that month. How did you work? How often did you work? And what did you learn?
I mean, all the time, really. I mean, I think that was kind of the point, is that you had that kind of focus and. It wasn't like shifts at all. You would get up, go for a walk or do whatever, then you would sit down and would start jamming, or maybe not everybody at once, or someone would be going off and cooking dinner and someone would be doing whatever. But all the time there was something going on. We had a drum kit in one bedroom where someone was sleeping, and then like a little 8-track. I had a little mini disc 8-track back then, I think. And sort of cables running all down the corridors everywhere to try and so we could get something resembling a demo. And, you know, every available space had like cables or amps or guitars in it. And you would just be picking up and working on stuff all the time. Then you would have dinner and then you would do the same. And then you would occasionally go to the pub and talk about voles with some researchers in the local pub, and then go back and write a song about it. There's a lot of quite amusing songs that came out of that, as well as the actual ones that we used.
But it was quite like a communal, like these kind of things, like you're all there together, like you're having bonfires and you're drinking beers and then songwriting, it's reflected, I suppose the songs are reflected from that experience. So yeah, I mean, I think it was the best thing we could have done at that point. Because up to that point, we'd always written in, we had a wee rehearsal space in Broughton Street in Edinburgh, bit of flooded. And that was actually, it was out of necessity more than anything, we found, because we had no space. So we thought, let's go to the Highlands. And that's somewhere that we'd started playing a lot, and I'd spent a lot of time in the Highlands, and it was somewhere I knew that would be good for the band, without any distractions of the city, or we were just concentrating on writing songs. And
you spoke a lot about tunes earlier when we started in our conversation about this, and I wonder if there's some kind of correlation between that moment where you have a bit of space just to think about music and the way that melody comes from that.
Yeah.
And the way that is there a song or a couple of songs in the record that most sort of exemplify the way that environment and
I think You Hold the World in Your Arms, which is kind of, I suppose, the most well-known Idlewild song, that came together very quickly in Inchnadamph in the cottage. And Rod was just strumming an acoustic guitar quite fast in a sort of Smiths-esque kind of way, and I had these lyrics in my notebook and I sang them over the top of it, and we added a melody line, which was later replaced by the string section. But the whole song came together within 15 minutes, you know, and that was very much, it sounded kind of like a weird like Highland folk song or something to begin with, because the melody was quite folky. But the minute that we got into a studio with the band and the, you know, electric guitars and stuff, it started to sound like that was one thing about The Remote Part, it's full of like unlikely anthems. And I think that was, you know, we started the record with that, and it is an anthemic song, but it's not like too obvious lyrically, or it does some interesting things with the melodies. Again, I suppose they are a bit more folky, which maybe roots the record more in Scotland than later. It couldn't be made by an American band, I don't think.
Interesting that you say that, yeah, because I always hear that folk thing. And I mean, I guess some of the subsequent records you've made and some of the subsequent records you've made, Roddy, maybe bring that part of your identity more to the fore, but to me it's stamped all over The Remote Part, you know, when you go back to that and you listen, and I'm almost sensing these songs with more traditional song structures that are then kind of, and I'm thinking about what you said about Lenny Kaye and the way that he sort of almost taught you to think in that way. Is that fair? Do you think this is a record where you've got songs that could be easily taken out of that production? And sort of,
well, we did that because we did a lot of acoustic. After The Remote Part, that's when we started playing acoustically. Before that, we would never have considered that. But after that, we realised we've got these really strong songs played on an acoustic guitar and a keyboard or whatever. They sound as good almost as when they're played with the full band. So it really gave us a lot of confidence in our abilities, just being able to kind of deconstruct our songs like that. And like, you know, going back to what Rod was saying about Lenny, that was, he started that off, that idea of like, you know, like, well, let's take it right back to what you've got here. And you've got really good melodies, so you can kind of do it in any way. So let's do it in this way. And Lenny also turned me onto a band called Badfinger. I'm sure you know Badfinger. And he was like, because he kind of sort of heard a lot of these songs in that style. I'd never heard of them. So he like, we listened to Badfinger together in the studio. And then he'd be like, I think you guys could do this kind of thing. You know, this is where... So that was kind of a bit of an influence on the record.
So he heard, maybe he heard that kind of, you know, that pop thing. Pop's a very, very good
word for me. You know, the harmonies and these kind of, like, I guess a bit like, you know, even Fleetwood Mac or something like that. A band like, you know, that a lot of people like because their melodies are so good. And he was like, you know, a lot of these songs, he was hearing that in that way. He wasn't thinking about it as like, you know, I don't know, Pavement or Sebado or something like that, whereas we'd referenced these bands before in records that we'd made. He wasn't hearing that at all. He was thinking more like Fleetwood Mac and Badfinger. Yeah. And that's the kind of record you should make.
Yeah.
So, and that sort of made us think, okay, well, if Lenny Kaye thinks that, let's do it.
One thing, we'll maybe come back and talk about a couple of specific songs as we go on here a wee bit. One thing I'm always interested in is the kind of relationship between you two and the band, and it's not just you two, but there is a kind of thing there, isn't there, about the way that you work together. What do you think the push and pull is there? Is there a particular part of that collaboration that you're aware of?
It's a weird relationship. Obviously, I think we're both aware of that. It's you're almost like a weird marriage, or you know, siblings or something, that we've been writing together, what, 25 years, and it's an intense thing to do with anybody. You know, writing music together is, whether it be words or music, is an expression of yourself, isn't it? And it's about as open as you can be with anybody, and as vulnerable as you can be with anybody, to put that out there. You know, something that you might think is awful. I suppose you have to be able to trust that person in that way. And so I suppose that there's maybe an unspoken trust, or maybe admiration for each other in that way. I suppose that you are able to do that in front of each other, which, you know, we've never really talked about, but we probably is, you know. You know, we'd send each other, I'd send Roddy a cassette with a bunch of, you know, noodles on it on a guitar, and then he would listen to it and go, right, that one's rubbish, this one's rubbish, I've got something for this one. And that would turn into a song, and that's how we started. Almost because it kind of separated, having to do it in front of each other, maybe, I suppose. But then you kind of graduate to being able to do that together, I suppose, as that trust develops, I suppose. And then you... But there is, yeah, there's a chemistry, isn't it? Like, there isn't any relationship that either works or doesn't. And when we write with other people and do other things, they can have a distinctly Idlewild flavour sometimes, but they're not quite that, because quite that unique chemistry.
It's very collaborative. I mean, like, you talk to, like, Norman Blake or, you know, other people from other bands, and quite often it's in bands that I hugely admire, they come to their band with the song, basically, or like essentially like the idea for the song, and it's still sort of their song, even though other people are adding things to it. But with Rod and I, it's not like that. We write the songs together. Neither of us, you know, we wouldn't be able to do it on our own. Well, certainly, maybe now we can do that. I mean, we've made records separately, but certainly when we started, we couldn't. We realised we needed each other in order to create songs, and we couldn't really work that. I mean, we were only teenagers, so we couldn't really work out why. But we knew that we both needed to be there for a song to happen. And obviously we had Colin, the drummer, and Phil Scanlon was the first bass player, then Bob Fairfield replaced him, and he plays on the remote part. So it was always a band setup generally, but we were the ones that were coming up with the songs. So yeah, I mean, I haven't analysed it too much, because I do think there is, and I do really believe in songs as being a kind of form of magic, without sounding like too, you know, kind of, I don't know, out there with my ideas. I do think that there's a magic to it that doesn't need to be explained. And there's a mystery to it too that doesn't need to be explained. It's just kind of what's so great about them. And sometimes people just meet and they're able to do this together. And I like that. And I like the fact that, you know, as Rod said, there's an awkwardness about it, because you're thinking like, why, how, you know, what are we going to do? You know, like, you know, I mean, just give it, you fall into your role quite quickly. And we've made lots of good songs. And it's not because we're not complacent about it, and we don't take it for granted that we can, you know, we have that opportunity to work together and this sort of working relationship, which seems to really produce good things.
So that, I love that. That's that, okay. So that's great, and I totally recognise that. However, if I can push a wee bit more on that, because I do know what you mean about the sort of magic that happens, but. No, not to analyse too much, but in the context of this record, is there a song or a couple of songs that you feel most exemplifies the way that you two collaborate? Where is it best kind of personified?
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, the first three songs in the Remote Parts? You Held the World in Your Arms, A Modern Way of Letting Go, and American English.
Yeah.
I think between those three songs, you've got a good indication of all sort of three styles. We're just talking about the Remote Part now, not in the context of Idlewild, because it's quite a lot of different sort of sounds we've explored. But I think that's a good... Just between those three songs, you've got kind of, I suppose, balladry, if you would want to call it that, for American English. You've got a really rocking song in Modern Way Letting Go, and you've got somewhere in between those things for You Held the World in Your Arms. And you've got, lyrically, you've got more introspection, you've got straight ahead, like, angst, I guess, and I don't know where I'm going here, really, what I'm talking about.
I'm not sure.
No,
either,
I'm just trying to...
I suppose in those, you can just in those three songs, you do definitely get a sense of how all the ways that we have and do work together and why that works, I guess. You get the way that, you know, here's a riff, let's just jam on that and see, and somewhere out of thin air, which always used to baffle me, Roddy would pull a lyric that fitted with it, and I'm like, how do you do that so fast, you know, and that would turn into a song almost, you know, you've got a hook and a lyric, oh, that's a song, and that would seem to happen really, really fast. And Modern Wave is definitely one of those songs, as actually was probably You Held the World in Your Arms. American English was one that went through so many iterations, but actually have been, I think, back to it.
The melody was always there.
Yeah, it was written in that, it was written in the flooded practice room on an acoustic guitar
quite quickly.
Yeah, really quickly. And it is that, I suppose, that it's that speed that is weird that we have, that some people will spend days on one song. We won't ever work like that, actually. When we do, and when we came back together to work again, having not worked together for, you know, nearly 5 years, to do Everything Ever Written, and we sat down in my living room for an afternoon and probably recorded 10 or 11 ideas, just really basic, though. But then, you know, we'd go away and listen, and maybe five or six of them really stuck, you know. And that sort of way of working, the chemistry just sort of seems to click, or it doesn't. And it's like, right, let's move on to the next thing. And weirdly, it clicks more often than it doesn't, without really overthinking it. As Roddy says, I suppose there is an element of magic in that.
I think also it's sort of something to do with, like Rod touched upon that before about trust. If you sort of trust the person you're with, you don't really doubt the fact you're going to come up with something. Like, I never, when we were working, we have like songwriting afternoons, I never go into them thinking, even if I don't have any ideas, I know we're going to write some stuff. I'm going to come up with something that's good. So, I mean, and that's a nice relationship to have with someone creatively.
Absolutely.
But you're not really ever worried about, you don't have to use all the stuff you come up with. I mean, you might use none of it, but like, you're not worried about being able to come up with content and being able to come, you know, like to, you know, put your ideas together, mm-hmm. your ideas combine into something. So,
and that, yeah, there's a freedom about that that I think is really preserved in well, all, you know, all your music, but we're talking about the Remote Part, and I think it is, there's a kind of free, a sort of joy about it as well that comes across. Do you think, in fact, you know, we'll come back to this later on, because I wanted to talk about one more, two more specific songs, and you can maybe talk about others that are favourites of yours. But the other one that I had down, you started talking about Norman, was Living a Hiding Place.
Uh-huh.
And for me, you know, again, there is that element of the fan club.
Oh,
in
yeah,
that
we're big fans of
the So talk about that influence. I know that the comparisons are odious, but we're talking about the fan club, so...
Mm.
All is fair.
We're all big fans of Teenage Fan Club. I mean, I think they were even recording next to us at the time. Oh, there was well, maybe
was
the record
before.
Yeah.
Doing Howdy, and we were doing Under Recommenders.
But, I mean, yeah, we're big fans of the way that certainly harmonically, like, and the way that they sing together. And essentially, and really, like, I suppose their records always, although they were so deeply rooted in that kind of West Coast American sort of sound, there was always there's definitely a sound of Scotland in there as well, always. Obviously, some records more than others, like Songs from Northern Britain, but that's definitely something that maybe came through on Remote Part and as an influence, I think, is that record, as Roddy touched on earlier, was not so much about sounding like an American indie rock band. It was about sounding like a band from where we're from that had influences from lots of other bands from all around the world, but that were a band that were comfortable being from Scotland and based in Scotland. And even in the way that Roddy was singing and in the way that the songs were written and presented, not thinking about having to sort of essentially indie-fy them, I suppose, by making them sound more like Pavement or making them sound more like whatever it was, you know. And I think that's something that Teenage Fan Club have always been really good at, is they've sounded like Teenage Fan Club. They've always sounded like Teenage Fan Club, and they're very comfortable in that. And they sound like a band that are from where they're from. And that's quite inspirational in itself, I think, that confidence, you know, in themselves as a band.
Yeah, they could make records. I mean, they made Bandwagon-esque, and then they made Songs in Northern Britain, two records I love, but they're quite different sounding records. And one's, you know, around that Bandwagon-esque time, they were playing with Nirvana and Sonic Youth, and by Songs in Northern Britain, they're sounding nothing like that, really. And I think, but they're the same band, and they're still a cool band, and they've still got loads of fans that, you know, and that, I think that's around the time of the Remote Part where we're starting to take an influence there, thinking, well, you know, we're the same band as that wrote all these punky, you know, punk rock songs that people like. We can change too, and we can do something. And just listening to those records gave you a confidence to think, well, okay, let's just strip away all the things that don't need to be there, and let's concentrate on the harmonies, because Rod and I sing really well together, and the melodies, and let's make the lyrics. I wanted to make the lyrics less vague, you know, like things that people could sing along with, like I said before, like anthemic almost, but not too straightforward, but still things like, you know, sing a song about myself, or you held the world in your arms, or live in a hiding place, and these kind of little phrases that people would remember and be able to sing along with. And Live in a Hiding Place, yeah, was influenced by Teenage Fan Club and by REM, another band that we listened to a lot in our sort of formative years. And particularly what influenced us is the way that Michael Stipe and Mike Mills sing together with each other. Quite often, you know, offset melodies and harmonies. They do that a lot, as do Teenage Fan Club. And that was a big influence for Rod and I, the way we approached singing and harmonies on the Remote Part.
And the vocals are fantastic on this record. Mm. And just pivot to the production for a moment then, in terms of the way that you recorded it. Was there a step change in the way that you worked in the studio? Did you spend a lot more time on this record? I know, well, apart from recording it three times.
Apart from starting it three times, yeah.
But when we started, we didn't. We got on with it pretty quick, didn't we?
Yeah, when we started, we did. And I mean, I think partly maybe too quickly. But, you know, when we restarted the record with Dave, and I think he was very aware of obviously the fact we'd started it twice, and was definitely, there was a more considered approach then. And I think, you know, I think we already had kind of nurtured a working relationship with Dave on 100 Broken Windows. We got on well. We knew what Dave is phenomenally good at, especially with us, was getting the best out of us. It wasn't that he was going to change us into something we weren't. And, you know, where Lenny maybe was pushing us to be things that we didn't think we would be, Dave was like, this is who you are, I'm going to make you the best version of that and record that. And that's what he's great at, and that's what we needed.
So how did he do that? So what were the, you know, put us in the studio with you, what was his kind of method of working with you?
It's like, I mean, he'll tell you this himself, I'm sure, but it's like, it's people management, isn't it? It's like, really, it's making everybody feel like they're the most important person when they're doing their thing, and that, you know, whatever they're doing is completely their own idea and completely believe in what they're doing at that time. And sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not, but it's about making that person feel comfortable and like they're able to give everything they've got in that and perform in that space at that time. And that is such a huge part of music production that's sort of overlooked, I think, is it's actually how well you can interact with people, and especially with a band with really strong characters in it who are going to disagree. And there were always disagreements, you know, whether it be about should we resolve this chord, should we play that chord, or, you know, no, that's 2119, not 2019 at table tennis.
He's a good sort of mediator, like sort of a counsellor between everyone.
Yeah.
And and he's very encouraging, and which is what we needed, because we're quite Scottish and reserved, I suppose. and he's not like that. So he would make us feel good about what we were doing, which was really important. And then, you know, I remember at the time we finished the remote part, it was You Held the World in Your Arms, and we're listening back to it with the string section. And, you know, he had it on loud, and he's like, this is an amazing song. And he was getting annoyed at us because we were all just sitting there being quite, I think we've done a good job. This is, you know, Quebec. And he was like shouting. He was like, it's like, you've made a really, you know, like that kind of thing. So I don't know. And I we trust him a lot. And like, we started to really rely on his ideas and his opinions. He became very important to the record very quickly. But I will say, I do remember we started recording it and we had to stop straight away because the World Trade Center, that was the first day of recording. That was when the terrorist attack on the World Trade Centers happened. So that put a weird atmosphere on the whole first, you know, recording session.
I bet it did.
Yeah, it was like the...
Where were you?
We were in Rockfield Studios. Rockfield. And we were just starting You Held the World in Your Arms, doing the drum tracks. And I remember like the assistant came in and said, you need to come and see the news. And yeah, but for the next sort of 4 days, nothing really got done. And then we started up again, but obviously the context of things always changes when something like that happens. So that was the start of the record. But things got going after that. But that was I always listened to that song thinking about that because of that was the nature of the way it was recorded. It,
And of course that was a bona fide hit record, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So was that your first record that charted to that level? I think it was.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the Broken Windows had done. We'd been on Top of the Pops and stuff like that. Had gone to the top 20, but you know, a classic indie band, like gone in the charts and straight out back out again. Whereas the Remote Part was a hit. You know, we were number three in the charts, and we were.
What was the impact of that on you? And just, I mean, look, it's, you know, it's a bit of a stupid question, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. What the aside from just the joy and the success of that, what was the sort of impact on you as a group? And
well, we were always made to feel, and I don't feel bad saying this now because we're not signed to Parlophone, and all the people that we knew that worked there don't work there anymore. So the music industry has completely changed, the landscape's changed. But we were always made to feel that we were not doing well enough. That was the abiding feeling I have. It's like it's number three in the charts, but it kind of should have been at number one. Or, you know, it should have been, you know, this single's gone in at number 12. There was never a lot of like, and you always got the feeling of the, you know, five of the shows are sold out, but the six of them still, you know, they're 80%. So you'd always be thinking like, you were always feeling like you were not doing well enough, you're underachieving. But we were label mates with, you know, Kylie Minogue and Radiohead and Coldplay, you know, and Blur. So, you know, we were bottom of the you know, less than that. So, that's my abiding memory. It's not one of like, you know, like punching the sky and like drinking champagne and feeling, you know, invincible. It was one of like always feeling like we should be doing better and working really hard. Like we were always on tour or doing something like that, interviews and all that kind of stuff, working really hard for, you know, for the record, but always feeling like we weren't getting as. And then during the whole campaign for the Remote Part touring it, everything kind of went wrong. Bass player left.
talk to us about that.
The whole promotion of the record was a bit sort of tarnished too. Yeah. The whole thing was a bit sort of troubled. I really feel that the record kind of suffered because of that. But, you know, in retrospect, you know, it did really, really well. I mean, it went gold and all that kind of stuff. It had a gold disc, but, like I say, the abiding sense was one of, like, we could have done better. It's weird to say now, but, you know.
Isn't it strange that, and it's... I mean, given you're talking about the way that things have changed, my God, you know, the days where lots of records got sold. Yeah. And then, listen, it holds its head up. It's you know, it's a beautiful thing, and it remains a beautiful thing. One of the things that I really wanted to talk about was Edwin Morgan. Mm-hmm. I actually saw Edwin Morgan at Falkirk College in 1982 when I was there studying graphics, and he came and did a poetry reading, and there was honestly maybe eight people there.
Yeah.
Okay. And he was magnificent and funny and beautiful and all of that. So this is one thing that when this record came out, I thought, oh my God, Edwin Morgan's on a cool record, right?
Yeah.
Talk to us about how that happened and you know, give us a little bit of an insight into that track.
Well, I'd gone to see Edwin Morgan and Alistair Gray do a talk at Waterstones in Glasgow. In between, we were touring a lot for Under Broken Windows, and I, you know, I'd moved to Glasgow and I went to see them talk, and it blew me away in a way that a lot of gigs I'd seen around that time it didn't. Just that idea of bringing his words to life, and there wasn't a backing band or anything. He was just standing up, and Alistair Gray and Edwin Morgan, they're really entertaining men anyway, and you know, charismatic. And so after that, I just got in contact with him, kind of as a fan. I just said how much I liked what I'd read and what I'd, that evening, and he asked me what I did, and I said, well, I'm in a band, and then we got that, started the correspondence, and we used to write letters to each other. Like, I'd send him postcards when I was on tour, and he would write me letters, and eventually it came to the idea of, I said, would you write something for my band, like this piece of music we were thinking about maybe opening the album with. The idea originally was it was going to open the record, not close the record.
Close it, yeah.
And he wrote that poem, Scottish Fiction, and I went round to his flat in Annie's Land with Rod's mini disc to record him speak it. And yeah, he was great, and we kept in touch, you know, till he passed away.
It's an amazing contrast as well, isn't it? That it's funny you say that you recorded on a mini disc, because there is this kind of sonic quality about it as well. But it's just that in many ways, I'm imposing my own kind of thing on this, but it almost feels like a lot of the themes that you've been working towards there start, you know, come together at the...
Yeah, well, Edwin was interested in, you know, he's interested in words and interested in, you know, when I went down to, you know, tape him speak the poem, we had a long conversation about Patti Smith, because we'd just recorded with Lenny, and he was a big Patti Smith fan, and he knew Allen Ginsberg and all that kind of stuff. It was sort of blowing my mind a wee bit, and he just wanted to be involved. He was in his 80s at that point, but he wanted to be involved in new things. And this he saw as a new thing. It was a Scottish band, and the theme of the record was one of identity, and, like, you know, how why you feel you belong somewhere, be it to a person or a, you know, a country or a town, whatever. And I was talking more specifically about Scotland, and he, I suppose, got that. But it was, I didn't say this has to be about this. I said this is the general themes of the songs, but Scottish Fiction, the poem that he wrote, was more specific to that, I suppose, like that sense of identity you find or don't find from the environment you grew up in.
Yeah, and it comes out really strongly, you know. It's a beautiful thing, and I'm sure that was a great moment for you. What was his take on the record as it?
Well, I mean, I sent him a copy, but like, I don't think he listened to a lot of rock music. He liked jazz. He was like, so I didn't expect him to. I didn't expect Edwin to want to, like, you know, be a part of the band or anything like that. I just thought it was originally, we didn't really know what we were going to do with it. Remember, we tried on a number of, even Craig Ward. He was involved in that at one point, wasn't he?
Yeah, we did a writing session together.
Craig Ward, the guy from Deus, you know, the Belgian band. He was kind of became a pal for a wee while in Edinburgh. We did lots of, we didn't even know if it was going to go on the record. Then we thought, actually, no, maybe it'll really work well at the start. And it wasn't until towards the end of the recording process that we had this song called The Remote Part, or In Remote Part, with this long end bit. And it was kind of My Bloody Valentine, Sonic Youth inspired, kind of just like washes of noise and things, and it just, his voice just seemed to flow on top of that, and it just concluded the record in a lovely way.
When you look back, I know artists don't always return to their music, but if you do go back to The Remote Part, how does it stand up for you?
Well, yeah, I went back to it last week for the first time in a long time, other than when we're trying to remember how songs go for a show. Yeah, it does. It's one you remember it differently. Definitely, you always do. As I think I said earlier, it is. It's like a snapshot of yourself, isn't it? And that time, and you always remember yourself maybe more favourably. But it was actually surprising that I thought, okay, yeah, this does stand up. It was a lot faster than I remember in general. A lot, I suppose, younger sounding. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I remember probably now, and this happens with every record you go back to and you listen to the songs that at the time you thought, well, this is the one, we've really written the one here. And, you know, it's those two songs that are probably the ones that you probably skip past now. And that's always the way, though, I suppose, like the immediacy of a song quite often is, yeah, it really hits you in the face right then and there, but actually there's not an awful lot of depth to it, and you kind of fall out with it over time. But yeah, as a record, I think it really stands up with, I've been sort of pleasantly surprised over this lockdown doing one of these Twitter listening parties as well with 100 Broken Windows, how that one stood up as well. I was almost sort of dreading having to listen along to it and comment on Twitter on it at the time.
I think you've been a bit hard on your own work. I mean, I think that...
I just always think that you kind of look back at these... Yeah,
you can separate yourself from it, I think.
I think you can.
One thing I think about the remote part is, in 2017, we did anniversary shows for it, and we've kind of tended to stay away from those kind of things, thinking it's more, you know, we want to focus on what we're kind of doing now. But it felt like the right time to do it, and we did like two nights at the ABC, which is a great venue. It was just a wonderful night, and like I think we were all taken by surprise by how the ticket sold out quick, and people were really passionate about it, the record. And there was a real outpouring of joy, and you could feel the joy from the crowd every time. They knew what they were going to, you know, they knew they were going to play the record as it was. And that really struck me as a moment when I realised how much that record meant to people. Okay, it was like, what, two nights in Glasgow, so a few thousand people each night. But I was thinking everyone owns a copy of this record and loves it, feels this way that this crowd are, you know, that are looking back at me feel. And it was quite, yeah, it was quite a powerful thing to have done something, made something that 15 years later is still affecting people. And to go back to the idea of it being slightly mysterious and magic, I don't actually know how we made it now. You know, we're talking about it a wee bit and like, you know, we're going, and I know like obviously the facts of where we recorded it and stuff, but there was an element of like, it just happened. And it just happened to work out well, and people still listen to it and think it is, you know, important to them.
Well, I think it is, and I keep saying it, it's a beautiful thing, and thank you both for talking about it so beautifully. And I love talking about music with musicians, you know, it's just great. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my uncut chat with Roddy Woomble and Rod Jones. It was a memorable evening spent in their company. If you haven't already heard the podcast dedicated to the remote part, you'll find it on BBC Sounds or wherever it is you source your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and rating. And do get in touch via BBC Radio Scotland social media if you've got a suggestion for another classic Scottish album you'd like us to explore. I'm Davey Scott. Thanks again for taking the time to listen.
Like to binge? Try box sets on BBC Sounds.